Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. Tonight I have a great guest, Larry Crane, editor-in-chief of Tape Op Magazine. That's a specialty recording magazine that's been around since the 90s. He's also an accomplished producer engineer, so I asked him what got him into this field.
The real background of the story is just being a music fan, you know? I think both of us, right? I'm a really rudimentary guitarist, and I'm fairly adept on bass guitar, you know. So that's, I really enjoyed. I kind of fell into that, and that's part of the story. But honestly, recording stuff began pretty young, and I was recording. I was in high school. We built some boxes, like little synthesizer modules and stuff, and we had an electronics class. And I got kind of fascinated with like oscillators and filters and stuff. And then I started just building little, like you'd find someone give you a circuit diagram or something and figure out how to build it. And then I was like, what do I do with these? And so I started recording to cassette, you know, home stereo cassette units, and then bouncing from one cassette to unit to the other. I was doing that. I bought like a little Radio Shack mixer. And then I would also, I bought some Electret mics at Radio Shack and record my friends and just odds and ends. And then I went to college and I was studying film. I was really into film, like special effects, you know, post Star Wars and all the movies that came out around then. Right. But I got kind of sucked into music. I started DJing at the college radio station and I think I started writing for magazines, even a little like small, I'm writing record reviews and stuff. And I was still doing the weird kind of weird music that I would make on my own, which was sort of more electronic and stuff. But I fell into this band called Vomit Launch. And it was 1985. And a friend started it, even though he never really played a show with us. But he roped in a couple other friends of mine. Trish DeRoland was the singer, and Lindsay Thrasher, real last name, was the guitar player. And that was kind of based on just who had what, you know. Lindsay had a guitar. And so I borrowed my roommate's bass and I was like, oh, I'll play bass. And the three of us kind of carried the band on from there with initially a different drummer or so. And then we got this guy, Steve Bragg, to play drums, and we did like four albums. And in those, you know, I got to go in the studio to work on those. And I became kind of the band, like de facto co-producer guy, you know, 'cause I just understood, you know, overdubs and what we needed to have ready before we went in there. So that was a good experience, you know. And the last two records we made, we're with a guy named John Bacigalupi. He had a label and a studio. And so we had unlimited studio time on those records, which was amazing. Right. You know, and then I really watched how he was working and to cut forward, he's now my partner with Tape Op Magazine as well. So it's kind of funny story how that all worked out. But yeah, so that after that, the band broke up in like 91, late 91. We toured around, we played shows with like Nirvana opened for us, the Magnetic Fields, the Replacements. We played with the Dead Kennedys, Camper Van Beethoven, Cake. It just goes on and on. Like we were like one of those bands in this weird middle time before everybody got really famous, like Nirvana, you know, and it was too late for punk rock and we broke up too soon for grunge or whatever. We weren't really that kind of band. I was living in Northern California actually back then. Yeah. So I was born in Berkeley and raised in Oakland as a little kid. And then we lived out near this place called Nevada City in California, which is kind of a hippie cool town, old gold mining town. And then I went to school in Chico, California, which is not that far away. And ended up there. That's where the band started. And we would tour from there. So we'd go to the Bay Area all the time. We'd come up north, up here, play Seattle, play Portland. And that's kind of how I ended up moving to Portland after we broke up. And when that happened, I was like, you know, I don't know, Brian, I don't know if you've ever experienced this where you're just like, I'm done with music. And it's not because we don't love music. It's just the everything around it, you know. And I was broke. I was so broke. I was the one stuck with the tour van, which needed lots of repairs. I sold the tour van to some deadheads, and I wanted to stop doing music, but I grabbed my old 4-track cassette and I set it up in my bedroom, and I started just churning stuff out. And I was like, well, I guess I'm not done. And that kind of led to like a first home studio in the early 90s. And then I was trying to learn how to record, and I had stopped all these magazines I was writing for, which really small little zine kind of things, but they all went under at the same time, like in the mid 90s. And I was like, well, I don't want to write for somebody. I want to write. And I was like, well, why don't I write about recording music, you know? And I went and I looked at all the magazines that were out, you know, like Mix, EQ, Electronic Musician, you know, in the States. And then there was Sound on Sound. I think Studio Sound might have been a UK one. There weren't a lot of magazines, and they weren't really focused like on the kind of scene, the underground alternative, whatever scene, you know. And I kind of saw like we could talk more about people making records in funky places at home. Maybe in trailers, you know, and wherever they may be. Right. And I thought there was just a room for that. And so I started this little, just really like Xeroxed magazine. And then my home studio got too busy and I moved out and started Jackpot Recording Studio, in a commercial space with, Elliot Smith as sort of a silent partner in a way. Like he wasn't financially involved, but he was working out of there and helped me build it and stuff so he could have a place to work out of. Yeah. So that was, it was a kind of a really, you know, I'll tell you, it was a really organic, natural evolution because, you know, once I started applying myself to learning how to record it, that felt pretty easy. I had a good enough electronics understanding to understand like headroom and all that kind of stuff. And, but I'm really just a music fan and I'm a real people person. So I think that that other stuff just kind of landed, you know, in the right place to be able to work on other people's music and enjoy it, you know, make the process fun, you know. And then the tape op started just getting busier. John Bacigalupi, who I mentioned earlier, he came aboard like 3 years in. So probably 1999, he joined up. We started the magazine in 96, or I did. And the studio move started in 97, just a year after the magazine started. And, you know, all that just kind of kept getting busier and busier. And here I am 25 years later.
That's a very cool story because you see his passion for the magazine. And if you ever read the magazine, you see it in the articles. Now he tells me how he funded Tape Op magazine and how it moved forward.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like the first 3 years, couple of ads. I didn't even bother anybody for ads, but a few people picked up on it. And Matador Records, Discord Records in DC, a few people like that were like, hey, we'll support you and get, and the ads were cheap as heck, you know? So there was that going on. But yeah, the financial aspect of running it back then was kind of messed up. There was no plan and it didn't work very well. And at the same time, I'm starting a recording studio and working, you know, 30 days a month, you know, in there, you know, I was in financial straits and I didn't have like a real strong business plan, you know, for the magazine. It was just kind of go for it. And, once I started using, you know, stopped Xeroxing and I started really going to printers and doing all the shipping, the, you know, I learned how to do like, sorting the magazines by zip code and taking it to the back door at the post office. You know, you save money and all that stuff, but it was just so much work. And I didn't really have a good plan. When John Bacigalupi came aboard, he was doing another magazine at the time as well. So he had some staff and all the protocol in place. He's really good at graphic design and layout. And I was like, great, you know, I can just focus on being the editor. And that's been a really fantastic partnership, honestly. about three years in, it was a little under 3 years actually. And that was great. It was good timing because then I could start paying off my credit cards. You know, the printing costs, like currently an issue of the magazine, it depends how many we're making or printing and sending out, which is like in the tens of thousands. And then, you know, every once in a while, there's like shifts in the U.S. Post Office changes their fees, you know, all that kind of stuff. So really, it's crazy. And during the pandemic, there was a shortage of paper. So, you know, it's always, and so paper costs go up. So there's just always a moving, thing with the cost. But, right now we found a newer printer a few issues back, and their quality is great, and their costs are fairly good. So that's been really nice, you know? Well, you know, our circulation kept going up. So then you're like, you're printing more, you're spending more, and you're hoping. So the basic model, obviously, with TapeOp now is that the advertising, since we do free print subscriptions in the U.S., we mail them out for free. So the advertising is covering the printing and the distribution and hopefully paying us a salary or something at the end of the day. And a lot of places, like, you know, some bookstores that used to carry them just focused on, now maybe that section is audiobooks or something like that, or it's just like, not, there's no magazine section in a lot of bookstores, even, let alone, you know, magazines at, you know, guitar shops or music stores, are there any recording, you know, stores, you know, places left, you know, you just go to Sweetwater, right?
Boy, he's absolutely right. I don't think you could find a pro audio shop if you tried. And plus, everybody buys online. So now Larry tells me about how he came into being with his Jackpot Studios.
A lot of the music I was around and doing was all, you know, mostly guitar-based bands, right? I mean, one of the things that really, that kind of worked in our favor was that, or in my favor, was that the studios preceding me, like around, you know, at similar cost, were, a lot of them were ADAT based, or, you know, and the ADATs were pretty difficult machines, if you probably know, hard to keep running, you know, and they didn't necessarily make the music sound any better. Let's just put it that way. You know, it's an early digital format. It's not good, you know? So when I opened, I was like, okay, I'm going to look for a 16-track 2-inch tape deck. And I got an old MCI from a place in North Carolina. Someone was getting rid of it and had it shipped out. And it was a beast, man. It didn't even have a tape counter. it was an MCI JH-16, actually, or JH-10 would be the body type, and then they called it a JH-16, and it was before they made, there was a transport called the JH-114, like the sort of cream-colored cast aluminum deck plate thing. It was before that, it was just a piece of stainless steel that would tend to warp, so your reels weren't even playing like, they were kind of on different planes, if you can imagine. And the electronics inside, one of the most fascinating things was that tape decks to do rewind, fast forward, play, and all these motions, if you don't have some sort of logic circuitry inside, you'd have to do that thing. If you remember, where you'd have to press, like, you hit rewind and then you press fast forward to slow down. And MCI tape decks were really, I mean, the sound quality, actually, they use the same exact audio cards as your Ampex decks did there. And then they just had their transports, which were coming from the video recording world, like the very first decks that could record like TV signals and stuff, like in the analog way, were using the 2-inch transports. And so they were coming off of that technology, actually. But yeah, anyway, it was a beast to keep running. I had to find a third party tape counter eventually, because, man, I punched in way too many times on the wrong chorus. The thing was, that was great, is everybody in town kind of followed along with what I was doing. It was like I was out in a band playing around the clubs then, mostly just locally, you know, but I knew everybody in the bands, and they'd say, hey, we got to come work with you. We got to do an album. We got to do a demo. We got to do an EP, you know. And we were busy, man. I was just working all the time. And eventually other people started freelancing and coming in or engineering there too. And initially a Mackie 32x8, which was regrettable. No polarity switches. There's a lot of technical reasons and hard to repair. Yeah. Like you think of a normal console, you pull out a channel strip and it's like this easy to swap them around, see where the problems are. Anyway, so the Mackies, you know, hey, it worked. I can't complain about the cost or anything, but a friend of mine found an Allen and Heath Saber series console down in Medford here in Oregon. And we drove down and grabbed it. It was pretty affordable and it had better preamps and equalizers and stuff. So I did that for a long time. Actually, I probably had that console for over a decade. And we moved, when did we move? It was about 10. So it was about 2007, 2008. We found out the building was going to get sold that I was in. And so I moved into my friends owned some property. They were building it, a new place up. So they built the suit for me. And I moved in there that year. And a little while after that, we got a new console. We got a Rupert Neve Designs 5088. Which is the new Rupert Neve console. And that thing is, it's beautiful. It's just, and I have a weird console. I had them build me one that has no preamps and no equalizers in it. So it's like mixing and routing and summing and all that kind of stuff. And it doesn't perform the typical, like, you know, microphone preamp part of the recording for you. So it's kind of funny. Ton of outboard gear. So that was kind of the trick, was like, I knew that I had plenty of like mic preamps and equalizers and all these things. So the console sounds amazing. I think it's one of the best consoles built. And so when we're mixing on that and stuff, people are just like, oh my God, wow. You know? So that's, you know, it took years. I mean, I think the studio started in 97 and here we are like, 27 years later. And, there's hardly any gear left in the studio that was there when I opened it, you know? So it's been that kind of journey, like of just upgrading everything all the time.
Boy, Larry's completely right. I can't stop upgrading my studio. There's always something I need to buy, fix, upgrade. Now he goes on to tell me about all that great outboard studio gear he has.
I've got enough outboard that, you know, it's a console's worth of outboard gear. So, you know, and there's tons of, I don't know how many, 3 or 4 major racks full of gear, you know, so there's plenty of outboard. A lot of the best of the boutique gear from the last, you know, 20 some odd years, 25 years. So, you know, things like Chandler and Daking and Great River, Grace, lots of really good stuff. And, you know, like 100 microphones, lots of ribbon mics like Royer and AEA, and lots of the new Telefunken mics, the new Flea mics from Europe. Things like that, some Soyuz mics, some really good stuff. You know, the Great River preamp, it's called the MP2NV. It's NV stands for the Neve style circuitry, I believe, that's inside of it. But it's just a you know, transistor based microphone preamp. Really, really easy. I got 2 channels of it, and it's got metering for like input and output. So you can always kind of tell what, you know, if you got signal, where it's at. And I frequently, for electric guitars, I almost always like double mic, you know, the cabinets, the speakers. And it's almost always like the Royer R10 or R121 ribbon mics is very common. And maybe like either depending on the kind of tones. It might be a dynamic mic, you know, just like an Audix i5 or what's that one? The Sennheiser E609. I rarely use like the Shure SM57s that you know, just because I feel like there's so many other options, you know. If it's sort of like a clean guitar playing, you know, either jazzy or like roots music or something, I've got a, they don't make this anymore, but I've got a Langevin CR3A, which is kind of like a Neumann U87 style mic. Yeah, Manly built those. Manly has a great rep. And it's a really good mic. It's got a good pad on it, so when things are loud, it doesn't crackle or anything, and it really sounds great on guitar amps. And I'll do that like with a ribbon, or I might do on the opposite side if it's like a really loud, like punk or metal or something, or just really brash tones on the guitar amp. I'll probably do something like a Heil PR30 or Audix i5, like I mentioned. So kind of go one way or the other with, and keeping a ribbon mic as sort of the baseline. And the thing that I do, even as I started doing this on tape, was I'll sum those mics as I track. So I don't like ending up with a whole bunch of tracks of the same thing when I get done with a record. Do you know what I mean? So I will blend the mics, and I'll have them coming either through the console and blend them in a bus, or I have a guy built me a custom, it's basically a box with a balance knob on it, left or right. And then you send the audio in and the audio comes out, and you just turn it to the left for more ribbon mic or the right for more whatever. And I'll just blend it into tape if I'm tracking to tape or to Pro Tools. And the great thing is, you know, you can be playing through that, and or someone playing the guitar, you just turn that knob and it shifts the tone, you know, because you're changing the mic balances. And it's great. Here's the esoteric thought on that. Every time I've tracked a band and I've done multiple mics on the speaker cabinets and then tried to blend them later in the mix process, it never sounds as good later as it did when I was tracking it. It always sounds that those two mics on the cabinet always sound more out of phase to me later than they did when I was in the tracking stages. And I don't know if that is just like, if I'm making that up, that's not really the truth or what is going on, but that's how I hear it. And I'm never happy. So I figure if I blend it in the analog realm, record the single track of it, then it stays where it is. That signal's locked in. And the thing is really like, say if you recorded a rhythm guitar and then we go, hey Brian, let's do another pass of that. And I'm going to put that on the left side of the old one on the right, new one on the left. We'll double it up, you know, stereo. And you're like, great, you want me to change my pickup, my guitar? You're like, no, just leave it as it is. I'll just turn that knob of the blend of the mics, the opposite of where it was. And it's going to sound different. And it's so awesome because it's like a very similar sound, but there's something different about it to kind of give you your ears a little cue, you know? Yeah. So I can work really fast that way. And tracks don't pile up, you know, I might go into, the luxury would be the Retro 176, which is a really expensive, tube compressor. And I have a two of those I usually use for vocals, but if it's like guitar overdubs, then I can use the best stuff. Right. Or, you know, actually one of my favorite lower budget compressors is the Drummer 1969. To me, that compressor, for some reason, it was designed by the late David Hill from Crane Song and sold through Mercenary Audio. There's also one called the 1968, which is just the compressor. This one has a mic pre that doesn't sound that great. But the compressor part of it is really good to me, especially on acoustic guitars, you know, but also the electric stuff. I'll always be using it in mixing and tracking. And it won't break the bank. You can find used ones out there, you know. That's pretty great. But if I'm doing like a lead guitar, you know, I might go for more room tone. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with doing that. You know, kind of open it up, maybe a stereo pair across the room, and then track that on its own track and see if, you know, we can add a little space to that, especially if someone's doing feedback at all. It really sounds good. Like, you know, even just like the drum overhead mics, if they're still up, you know, track those and get some of this noise on there. because the feedback recorded with like a mic right up on the grill of a cabinet just sounds terrible to me. You know, it just sounds like a sine wave, you know, but then you hear it in the room and it's like exciting. So yeah, leads and feedback, I'll get some room mics on there and usually separate so that I can kind of blend them in. Although I might go crazy and just blend them all together and just say, that's the sound, you know, because once again, it's like, I just commit to it and keep moving. Like I don't do a lot of EQ and tracking. I'll do that mic blend. I'll move mics. I'll change mics. I'll change the amp. It took me years to get comfortable with walking up to a guitar amp and just tweaking it to what I want to hear. Cause I always thought that was sacred and someone would get mad at me. And then I realized you got to make those calls and help people out. And I realized how much people appreciate that when you do it well. So yeah, I'll be like, you'll be like, give me every single pickup selector, you know, like, okay, that one stay there, you know, cause people might have a habit of picking something too shrill or too deep or whatever it might be. Guitars especially, man, I love to just say, "What, play me how you play the whole song." Okay, let's break that into like 8 different parts, you know? Like sometimes taking a chord and saying, play the low part of the chord and not the high strings, not play the high strings of the chord. You know, a little bit Def Leppard style, right? But you know how that works, man. You can create something that actually sounds bigger, but it doesn't even have to be as loud, you know, because you've really layered it in and you broke it all apart and then double up parts and separate parts, and things can just have a lot more space to work, and then you don't have just one loud guitar blasted through the whole song. Totally. I mean, I hear it on your productions and stuff. There's space for everybody's parts, and you know, there's dynamics and parts lay out and come back in. And generally I'm mixing out of Pro Tools back into Pro Tools through the console. So I will be like using outboard stuff. I have to pick a certain outboard thing if I want anything extra. and I love that, you know? So I'll go like, oh man, you know, this kind of guitar tone, it'll sound better through a Focusrite Red 2 than like the Great River EQ2NV or the Chandler Curve Bender. I know it'll have a different tone. So I'm kind of like really picking EQs based on, you know, where their frequency bands lie and how I know they're going to react to certain sounds. So that's kind of fun. I accumulated so much outboard gear because I hated my old console. So I stopped using the mic preamps and the EQ and that old Allen and Heath Saber console. And so I just would start buying, I would get, you know, like, oh, I got this Jeff Daking EQ. I'm going to use that. So I started getting all these different products to just replace the console that I was not that enamored with. And then when it came time to buy a beautiful console, it would have been, you know, to load that with mic pre's and equalizers would have been another, back then, at least 60,000 to 80,000, you know. And I think I spent about, at the time, under 60 for it, I think. But, you know, I think it's worth far more than that now. 1,000 points, I think, almost, on the batch bay. We got it set up, so we still have tape decks. I've got a 16-track Otari MX-80, and a 24-track Otari, and a 2-track for mixed amp. And so we can do stuff in there. We have a point on the patch bay where it's just 48 mult points. So you plug in a cable, you can get 3 outputs. So we can set things up where you're tracking to tape. You've got everyone has a headphone mixer in front of them, so they make their own mixes right off of tape. And then I listen to the console, right? Because I'm listening to what's going to tape off the from the tape deck into the console. And then there'll be an extra patch set up so that as we're listening back to a take, we can dump it all over to Pro Tools to continue working in Pro Tools if we want. I have 3 ISO booths in about a 600 square foot live room with about 11 foot ceilings, I think. We have not a ton of guitar amps, but some interesting things. I've got an old, if you remember Rivera that was designing stuff for Fender back in the day, there's a Fender concert from like the early 80s or something. That's a combo 12-inch speaker, 50 watt. It is one of the best recording amps I've ever heard. I don't use the overdrive channel. Sounds like muck to me, but the reverb tank and the you know, and then just the preamp, you know, and EQ stage and the presence knob all just really work well. And I've done whole records where that's the single amp all through the album, you know, and it just, you can get almost any kind of sound you want out of it. And a single 12, you know, that's in good shape sounds so good, you know, for recording, I think. So I really like that amp. I've got some other funny things like Magnatone. You remember them? I got like an old Magnatone that someone completely, he rebuilt to the point that he said, you know, I could have just built you an amp from scratch. Yeah, I love spring reverbs. So I got a couple of different versions of the Demeter rack mount spring reverb. And then I've got one from Benson. That's my friend Chris Benson. And he's loaned us amps too at times. Oh my God, they sound so good. Those are amazing. Just beautiful. Everything you want an amp to be, you know, you put like one mic in front of it, you're like, well, I'm good. That sounds great. You know? And he made a spring reverb, rack mount to space ring spring reverb called the Tall Bird and Tall Bird Studio. And that thing's beautiful. It almost sounds like a plate reverb. It gets so long and lush. But we've got an EMT 140 plate reverb, the Ibanez AD202 analog delay. You ever seen those? That's an 80s thing, you know, and a full tone tube tape echo that's like an Echoplex. Very cool. You can get your hands on that little bar and sweep the time around, you know. And Roland, the Space Echo, you know, I got one of those 201s.
You know, it's absolutely true. You can't have enough guitar amps, effect pedals, effects, outboard gear. And when you're an audio junkie like us, it just comes with the territory. Now he tells me how he prefers mixing.
I think I really like mixing. I've done a lot more of that the last 4 or 5 years. And, you know, I mix a lot of projects I don't record. And I think that teaches you a lot too, because then you kind of go, wow, why did they do this way? This sounds awful. You know, so you know what to avoid next time you're tracking, but also you hear things that are so good. It gives you like, when you hear a real multi-track, you know, of something that's well done, you're like, damn, I don't really have to do much to make this work. And then, so you think, I always think like, well, how did they get such good sounds? What is it about this record that, you know, the sounds are also complementary in the multi-track and that we're not fighting to get a mix. So, you know, it makes you kind of up your own game, right? I could track better next time. Absurdly love like the challenge jobs, like where someone did, they want it to be better than they recorded it. You know, like they just did a pretty rough job probably at home and they could imagine the music being bigger and better sounding. And I love kind of taking that on sometimes. I think I'm really a big fan of people just trying to do it themselves. Just go for it, man. You know, like if you fail, you fail, but you know, you can sometimes by doing stuff even wrong in quotes, but you know, you can make something unique. And you know, there might be some things that are pretty bad because you know, the mics are overloaded or there's clipping or there's just issues, but man, sometimes you hear stuff that's just such a good song that you want to make it feel better so more people can enjoy it instead of something that maybe sounded rougher, you know. I like helping people out. I like giving them something better to take home or to present to the world or whatever it is. I mixed a record a few months ago off of, oh my God, what was that thing? 8-track cassette. You know, there's reduced fidelity, one might say. The artist made it part of the tone of the record. It's like he wasn't trying to fight it and make it something it wasn't. So in the end, it's kind of cool. There's like these distorted vocals and lots of textures that you can only kind of get by doing that. And it was kind of cool. I enjoyed working on it. I was like, you know, using, I dumped it into Pro Tools, and then I used a lot of the Isotope RX product where it's a, you know, you can do noise reduction and things. So that really helped us, you know, kind of clean it up and make sure we got rid of any kind of clicks and pops and all those weird noises. I work with a number of clients where they track a lot of it at home and then bring it in, and we track more on it, and then we kind of finish it off, and I kind of co-produce the final stages of it. And that's kind of cool because, you know, I'll have a different perspective than they will, and I'll be able to go, hey, let's, you know, what if this part was cut out here and does this? And that can be really rewarding, you know, for their, they get a new perspective through me, you know, and then we get to really fine tune the mixes and rock it out. And I really enjoy that process a lot. And I'm not one of those people that's like stuck in the past and I'm like, oh, I want to see a project from the beginning to the end, all the way through every single time. Like, you know, sometimes you get better results if you don't work that way. If I'm just mixing, or if I start the project and track the basics, they take it home and overdub and they come back to me, we mix it, then I might have a much better perspective than if I did all the overdubs with them. You know, I'll be less precious for sure, man. You know, like I said earlier, you know, Tapop is free subscriptions. You know, you get PDF all over the world, and then you know, print subscriptions are totally free. Just go to tapop.com. Jackpot Recording Studio, we're here in Portland, Oregon. Yeah, I got a great manager that runs it, and we've lots of records going on. Someone's in there right now doing something, you know, so it's a nice busy place.
That's a wonderful sounding studio. You should go visit him and record your next project there if you're in the Portland, Oregon area. And also, if you need Tapop Magazine, just get your free copy today.